Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Mem Hei Amud Aleph, four lines down. The Gemara says, Lema tnuli ba'ali ve'esmachimo tinayehi. This refrain that we used yesterday in discussing whether a shushbin can exempt himself from having to pay where there's a situation or circumstance that the other party's not there, and the example or the paradigm that we used was with regards to a woman who's getting married, whether she has to return her kesef kiddushin. Over there we said that she can say, if the husband passes away, tnuli bali, give me my husband, and then I'll be happy to get married. I'm not the one that is being me'akev, I'm not the one that's causing the problem here, and therefore I should not be obligated to have to give back my kesef kiddushin. So we use that same principle, or that same paradigm, by the shushbin, who says, I'm ready to make the wedding, I'm ready to pay back my debts incurred as a shushbin, just have him get married. He's not around. He passed away. Then unfortunately, I can't be there to do that. But there's no reason why I should be obligated to his yavam or to any other party in terms of the monetary payment, because it's a quid pro quo. He came to my wedding. I'm going to come to his wedding. If he doesn't have a wedding, then there's no reason for me to have to pay. So Gemara says this concept or this idea that says that I'm ready to perform whatever I am obligated to do, but I'm unable to because something is missing. Maybe that's a machloket tanaim. Titanya, Rabbraita, Areset Aisha, someone who gets engaged halachically to a woman. Bitula gova mataim, if something happens by which they are now separated, a bitula gets from her ktuba 200 zuz, v'amana mane, and a amana gets 100 zuz. The problem with this is, and the Rashbam already notes that, is that generally we don't have a ktuba by an arusa. And number two is it's not even clear that a woman who does not have a ketubah as an arusa, but she's entitled to the kesef of the ketubah. We know that a married woman, one who has nisuin, there's already a tanae ketubah, that even if she doesn't have a ketubah, she's entitled to the 100 zuz for an amanah, 200 zuz for a betulah. The question with regards to an arusa, it's less clear, and that the Rashbam points out already. Ubikatov la min erusin. It's a case where he already gave her a ketubah at the time of the erusin. Because when you don't write a tuba at the time of the erusin, that's a question, iktubot. And truthfully, it is a machloket rishonim. In terms of the outcome, Rashi over there seems to indicate in a number of places that an arusa gets matayim and maneh, irrespective of whether she has a tuba, that is the default. The Balei Tosafot argue on Rashi there and say that it's only if she has a tuba at the time of erusin that she entitled to that. Without a tuba, she's not necessarily entitled to it. So over here, the Rashbam makes that point that it must be a case where he wrote her a ketubah, and that's why she's entitled to the monies. Now, makom shenagulak zir kiddushin, makzirin. In a case where the marriage falls apart, then the kesef kiddushin, if it's the minag makom, she returns the kesef kiddushin. Again, yesterday I mentioned or noted the example that is similar to today, where if the engagement falls apart or something happens, that the woman gives the ring back. In that situation, it would be similar here to give back the kesef kiddushin. She may not be obligated to do it because it's her money. It was the consideration for the kiddushin, but the minhag in some places was to return the kesef kiddushin. There are rishonim who believe that she has to keep at least a pruta of it, otherwise the whole kiddushin will fall apart, and then she wouldn't be entitled to her ketubah, but she has to give back the remaining amount of money. Others say it doesn't make a difference once the kiddushin is done, then it doesn't matter what she does with the kesef kiddushin. Makom shenagu shelo lachzir kiddushin, en machzirin. Places where they don't have the minhag to return the kesef kiddushin, then you don't give it back. Divrei Rabbi Natan. That's Rabbi Natan's view. Rabbi Yehuda and Anasi Omer, be'emet amru. Truthfully, this is what they said. Makom shenagu lachzir machzirin. The place that it's a minhag to give it back, they give it back. Makom shenagu shelo lachzir, en machzirin. Place where they don't have a minhag to give it back, they don't give it back. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi just said exactly what Rabbi Natan said. So then, what's going on here? What's the argument between them in the Braita? Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Hainu Tanakamo. The Gemara asks the question, they're identical in their positions. Elalav, Tznili Bali, Vesmachimo, Ika Binayu. Situation, or the ability for the woman to make such a claim, is the difference in their positions. Vekasure Mechzera, and it's missing some words over here. Achiktoni, and this is what it should have said. I marry Sitaisha, someone who gets electrically engaged to a woman. Bitula go va mataim, va mana mane. So this is what we had before in the Braita. that a betula will get 200 and almanah get 100. But med dvarim amurim, when is that true? Dehadar bei ihu, when he backed out of the marriage. Aval meita, if she passed away, makom shenagu lachzir machzirin, then in the place where the minhag is to turn the money, where the woman passes away, they give it back. Makom shenagu shelo lachzir, ein machzirin. In a place where that's not the minhag, they don't return it. V'davka shemeita hi. That's only if she passed away. Aval meitu, ein machzirin. But if he passed away, then we don't give the money back. My taima, why wouldn't you give the money back when he passes away? The failure to consummate the marriage, why should it make a difference if she passed away or if he passed away? She can say, Tnuli bali, v'esmachimo. I'm not under any obligation to refund the kesef kiddushin because I'm not the one stopping the kiddushin from going forward. The husband passed away and I'm happy to get married. He's not here. Then it's not my fault that we're not getting married, and I'm going to keep the kesef kiddushin. The guards to the husband, if she passes away, then obviously she is the me'akevet. She's the problem in the lack of consummation of the marriage. In that case, it's subject to the minag hamakom. The Rabbeinu Gershom says that he can't say the opposite, which is, avol bididei, lo yitrin on the meimar, tnuli ishti v'esmachima. He can't make the claim, give me my wife, and I'll celebrate with her. Havlav hoche lo akzira kiddushin. Otherwise, I won't give back the kiddushin, mishom. Tulo tofis bishutei kiddushin. He doesn't have the kiddushin in his possession. So he can't make the claim, give me the wife, and then I'll pay the pesef kiddushin, because he already paid the pesef kiddushin, it's out of his possession. So that demand or that statement is not meaningful from his perspective. From her perspective, it's meaningful because she's the one holding on to the pesef kiddushin at this point in time. And that's why he's precluded from making such a statement.
So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi comes along to say, Ben Metamru, Ben Meitu, Ben Meitahi, irrespective of who passes away, Makom Shenagu Lachzir Machzirin, in the place that they have the minhag to give it back, they give it back. Makom Shenagu Shelo Lachzir, Ein Machzirin, in the place where the minhag is not to return it, then they don't give it back. Velo Matzi Amro, and you cannot invoke the principle of Tnuli Bali Vesmachimo. That's not your prerogative, it's not your right to make such a claim. And therefore, irrespective of who passes away, or irrespective of the cause of the failure of the marriage over here, it's always subject to the minhag hamakom. Whether the minhag is to return the monies, whether the minhag is not to return the monies when there is a failure in the marriage. Now, as the Rashbam points out over here, when he backs out of it and he wants to divorce her, then in that case, she has a right or an entitlement to her ktubah. So if she's going to take her ktubah, then, if it's subject to machzirin or ein machzirin, we would deduct the case of kiddushin from the amount of the ktubah that he has to pay. He still has to pay the ktubah when it's his fault in terms of the breakup of the marriage. That's whether he wants to divorce her, or whether he passes away and she's an almanah and an irusin. Here that she has a ktubah, she's entitled to that payment. The minhag hamakom would then govern whether she has to return the case of kiddushin, and that would be a deduction against the amount of the ktubah that has to be paid if the failure is from the husband's side. The Balei Tosfot will point out that when we read the Braita before, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and Rabbi Nathan's positions were identical. How did the Gemara know to say that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is the one who is, quote-unquote, machmir over here, and Rabbi Nathan is the mekil, which is that Rabbi Nathan says that the woman has a right to invoke the principle and keep her kesef kiddushin, whereas Rabbi Yehuda Nasi says she doesn't have that right. It could have been just the opposite, and you could have changed the Braita to read the opposite way around. How did the Gemara know which of the two positions to change in order to make them different? So the Balei Tosafot tell us that there is a principle in general, which is the Tana Batra L'Tfuye Ga'ati. The latter Tana always comes to add on. He's always doing something more than the Tana Kama. So the fact that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi comes after the Tana Kama, we'd expect from him to be adding something to the situation. And that's why the Gemara set it up in that manner, even though, again, their statements are identical. So now the Gemara says, well, that's not the right way to view the machloket. Ela tekuli ama, yichola shetiamer tnuli bali v'esmachimo. She has the right to invoke that principle. Both Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and Rabbi Nathan agree to that. Udemitu kuli ama lo plige. Also, if he passes away, nobody argues that that is the circumstance in which she can invoke that principle. So therefore, she can keep the kesef kiddushin, because it's his fault that there is no consummation of the marriage. She can invoke the principle of, I'm ready to get married, he is the problem, and therefore she keeps the kesef kiddushin. Keep ligay b'shemei tahi. The machloket is when she passes away. They're arguing about whether Kesef Kiddushin is basically like throwing it in the ocean. It's sinking, it's drowning. The word tibua or litboa means to sink or to drown. And that's what it means over here. When one gives Kesef Kiddushin, what is the expectation when they give it? Is the normal way that people view Kesef Kiddushin is that it is gone. It's done. Once you give the Kesef Kiddushin, it's functioned in its purpose. But there's no way you're going to see that money anymore. It's as if gone. You can kiss it goodbye. On the other hand, maybe there's a possibility, which is Rabbi Natan Savar, Kiddushim lav letibuin nitnu. Rabbi Natan says when you give Kesef Kiddushin, there is somewhat of an underlying understanding when you give the Kesef Kiddushin that it doesn't get lost, but that it's premised on them completing the marriage or consummating the marriage. The other interview, the Nisi believes that Kiddushim are letibuin, which is, once you've given them, they're gone. It's as if it's a sunk cost for you. And anything that happens afterwards is incremental to the Kesef Kiddushin. You have no rights to a refund of the Kesef Kiddushin. Gemara says, it's a nice explanation, but you have a serious problem with this explanation. If that is the explanation, then it should be Mi'ikar Adin. The halacha should be that if Kesef Kiddushin is not given away, is not considered to be lost, then there should be a need or a right to have it refunded. If it is lost, then it should be gone and there should be no right to have it refunded. On the other hand, the Braita says, V'hamakom shenagu lachzir machzirim ktani. Braita seems to indicate that it's all talui in the minag makom. So if you have a halachic principle, which is it's lost or it's not lost, then that's black and white. Either you can get it back or you can't get it back. Why should it have anything to do with the minag makom? So even though there are times, there are places that we find that the minag makom can override the halacha, but that's only in a case or a situation in which the minag makom comes from some sort of misora, some sort of place that would have give it a strength to overcome the halacha. But over here, doesn't seem to be that it's a long-standing practice or there's a reason behind the practice that would say we should override the underlying halacha of kiddushin is tibuin ninu or lo de tibuin ninu. So it's hard to argue that that's their machloket given the fact that Braita speaks about makom shenagu. Where it says, Achi kamar, v'sivlonot v'day makom shenagu lachzir machzirin. So we add in an additional gift over here, which is you have kesef kiddushin, and then you have the sivlonot. So the sivlonot are the way Rashbam explains them, tachshitin, shesholeach la'usoto la'achar shekidsha. These are the gifts, the jewelry that he sends to his fiance, to his future wife, at the time that they have the kiddushin, or immediately after they have the kiddushin. So that is subject to the minhag makom. So now the Gemara is bifurcating the din and saying kesef kiddushin is subject to the halacha. Is the kesef kiddushin lost or not lost? Sivlonot has to do with the practice of the location. There's no halacha there, but rather it has to do with makom shenagu. So now the Gemara says, b'hanei tanei, k'hanei tanei. And then this machloket tanaim between Rabbi Natan and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi is similar to another machloket tanaim that we have seen, the Tanya. Kidsha b'kikar. Got married to her with kesef kiddushim of a kikar. Kikar is an extremely large amount of money. You see it in the Torah with regards to the accounting of the Mishkan. When they want to figure out how much kesef and how much zahav that they have, they use the term kikar and maneh. Maneh is 100 zuz. A kikar is 25 maneh. So it's 25 times 100 zuz or 2,500 zuz. It's a very large amount of money. So he gave that as the kesef kiddushin. Betula gova matayim. A betula is entitled to 200 zuz. V'amana maneh, divrei Rabbi Meir. And the amana gets a maneh, that's what Rabbi Meir says. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, betula gova matayim, v'amana maneh. The betula gets 200, the amana gets a maneh, umagzeret lo et ashar. And she refunds the remainder of the kiddushin money. The kikar that he gave her is a very large sum of money. It's 25 manim. Over here, he owes her either 2 maneh or 1 maneh. If she's a betula, it's 2 maneh, which is 200 zuz. If she is a amana, she gets 100 zuz. So then you get, out of the 25, there's still 23 or 24 of kesef kiddushin in excess of the ktubah. So what Rabbi Yehuda says is, you have to refund that excess. You have to give back the kesef kiddushin that's in excess of the amount of her ketubah. Rabbi Meir seems to say that she keeps all the kesef kiddushin, we ignore it completely, and all she does is gets her ketubah. And she gets her ketubah incremental to the kesef kiddushin that is there. Rabbi Yossi Omer, kitsha be'esrim, noten la shloshim chatzein. If he was mekadesh her with 20, then he gives her an additional 30 halves. Kitsha be'shloshim, if he married her, he used kesef kiddushin with 30, noten la esrim chatzein. Then he gives her 20 halves. So over here it's interesting because why is he expressing things in what we call half sellas? What's the reason for expressing things in half coins instead of full coins? The Baalei HaTosafot say over here that that was the way that they transacted, or that was a normal way for them to express monetary amounts or values. They used to use the half sella as the measurement of value. So we have the Tana Kama, who's Rabbi Meir, saying that she keeps the kesef kiddushin, even though it's an excessive amount, plus she gets her ketubah on top of that. Rabbi Yehuda says she's entitled to her ketubah, but she has to refund the kesef kiddushin. And then Rabbi Yossi saying something cryptic, which is, if he gave 20, he gives 30. If he gave 30, he gives 20. So the Gemara is going to explain the machloka, and then we'll understand what Rabbi Yossi just said. B'mai eskina, ilei mashim meita, if she passed away, mid la ketubah. Then what is there to speak about? She's not entitled to ketubah if she already passed away, if she predeceased her husband. Vela shemeitu. Must be a case where he passed away. Amai machzeret lo et ashar. Why is she giving back the kesef kiddushim? Neimatz nuli bali besmachimo. Because she can invoke the principle that we said before everybody subscribes to, which is that, give me my husband and I'll consummate the marriage. If the husband's not here, it's not my fault, and therefore I shouldn't have to give back the kesef kiddushim. Ella, Be'eshet Yisrael, Shizinta. It's a case where, between the Erusin and the Nisuin, she had an extramarital affair, and that causes the breakup of the marriage. Obemai, what's the situation? Iberatzon, if she was a willing participant in this extramarital affair, meet la ketubah. Then why is she entitled to a ketubah? A woman who has an extramarital affair forfeits her right to the ketubah. Vela, Be'onis, Vela Be'onis, Ella Be'ones. It's a case where she was raped. Mishra Sharile. She can continue through with the marriage. She's not a surah to her husband in a case of rape. She was an unwilling participant in the extramarital affair. And the husband can continue through or can go through with the marriage. Vela Be'eshet Kohen Shenenza. It's a case of a wife of a Kohen. She has Erusin, not Nisuin. And then, unfortunately, Chas V'Shalom, she was raped. Ubikidushin litbuin itnu kamiflage. And they're arguing about whether kiddushin is given to be given away or it can be refunded. So in this case, they can't consummate the marriage because a kohen is not allowed to marry a zona. The definition of a zona is any woman who engaged in a problematic bi'ah. So here, there's a problematic bi'ah, even though it's not her fault. And she was ne'anas. She was raped over here. Nevertheless, the fact that an individual had bi'ah with her when she is a married woman, when she already had erusin, that is a bi'ah of znut. And that bi'ah of znut makes her into a classification of a zona. Again, not in the classic sense of what we think of zona, but the definition of the Torah of a zona. And a kohen is precluded from marrying a zona. So in that case, they can't consummate the marriage. So the question is, what do we do in this case? It's not the husband's fault that they can't complete the marriage. Wasn't that he passed away? It's also not the woman's fault that they can't consummate the marriage. Something happened to her, Be'onis, that she was completely not in control of. She didn't pass away, but she should be entitled to her ketubah. So the question is, she's getting her ketubah. What about the kesef kiddushin? Here, the failure of the consummation is not the responsibility, really, of either party. So then, in that neutral circumstance, does the kesef kiddushin go back or not? So this is the answer to that question. Rabbi Meir savar kiddushin letibuin ninu. Rabbi Meir believes that once you give the kesef kiddushin, it's gone. And therefore, she's entitled to her ketubah. And the kesef kiddushin, we didn't even speak about. Nothing to talk about. That's hers to keep. Rabbi savar lav letibuin ninu. Rabbi believes that they're not given away. They're not gone. If you can't consummate the marriage, the kesef kiddushin should be refunded. And that's what we say here, that he gets back the kesef kiddushin minus the ketubah, which is that she returns it minus the value of a ketubah. Rabbi Yossi, misapkele. Biosi is in a doubt as to whether the halacha is like Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Yehuda. Ilu tabuin nitnu, ilo. Is the money that's given kesef kedushin given away and done with? You can't get it back. It's a sunken cost. Or do you have a right to receive it back in a situation where the marriage fails? Vehilchach. So therefore, this is Rabbi Yossi's opinion. Kitcha be'esrim, if he got married to her with 20, notein la shloshim chatzein. He gives 30 halves. Kitcha be'shloshim, notein la esrim chatzein. Then he gives her 20 halves. So here, Rabbi Yossi's opinion is that I have a safek. In the case of a safek, I need to figure out, what do I do in terms of paying out this woman? This woman's entitled to her ketubah, because marriage is going to fail. They're going to have to get divorced at this point. And therefore, she's entitled to her ketubah. The question is about the kesef kiddushin. The kesef kiddushin, does it need to be refunded or not? We have a safek. We don't know what to do. That results in a case or a situation in which you have mamon hamutal b'safek. Mamon that is left b'safek. So the principle that the Gemara or Rabbi Yossi is invoking here is, mamon hamutal b'safek chokim. They split it. So that leads us down a path which we've gone through a number of times here. For the Rashbam, that's really nice, because the Rashbam thinks the halacha is like sumchus, that mamon hamutal b'safek is chokim. And this is another proof, another feather in his cap, that the Gemara believes mamon hamutal b'safek is chokim, because here's a stam Gemara that seems to be following the position of sumchus. On the other hand, the Bali Tosafot are not shleimim in this, and they note it here, and they reference you back to the Tosafot back on Daf Samach Bet Amud Bet, where the Bali Tosafot argue on the Rashbam and say that the halacha is not like Sumchus, but rather like the Rabbonon, that Amotzi Michavero Alav Araya, and that should be the din here as well. But that's not what the Gemara says, and that's not what Rabbi Yossi says. So Tosafot back on Samach Bet Amud Bet has a list of cases where the Gemara concludes Mamona Mutaba Safek Chukim. But he can't agree to the Rashbam's reasoning, which is that's because we pass like Sumchus, because of Rabbeinu Tam, the Bali Tosafot believe we do not pass like the Sumchus. So what they say is that the Chachamim, in certain circumstances, invoke this principle, even though it's not the underlying or default principle. In certain cases like this, they said that the better outcome is Mamona Mutaba Safek is Chukim, even though that's not the principle which governs usually. So since that is the case, the Chachamim stated it. It's not telling you that's the halacha generically. Can't extrapolate from it. In this particular case, they felt that was the proper outcome. Some argue that it's not only the proper outcome, but there is no motzi michavero alav araya here. Because it's unclear who's the muchzak in the money. You need somebody to be muchzak in the money in order to have a motzi michavero alav araya. So our assumption would have been that the woman is muchzeket in the money, and therefore, the burden of proof would be on the husband to prove that he's entitled to the money. Like the Rabbeinu Gershom said before, that the kesef is considered to be in her possession, and therefore, it would be a motzimi chavero lavaraya, would be the obligation of the husband to extract it from the wife. But some argue that she is, in a sense, no more muchzeket in the money than he is. First of all, you have the ketubah payment. So that is an offsetting payment that you have to deal with. So he has money, and she has money. So now maybe he's the one who's muchzak, because he has the payment of the ketubah, and his payment of the ketubah is going to exceed the value of the kiddushin. So maybe she should be a motzi mechaber alav araya. Or you can say here, maybe because she's holding the shtar ketubah, that she's considered to be the muchzak, or because he's holding the kesef, is he considered to be the muchzak? So in this case, maybe it's not even clear who is the muchzak in the case, and therefore there's no application of motzi mechabero alav araya. So some claim that fundamentally there is no motzi mechavero olav araya, although the Bali Tosafot argued that that is the case here. V'lama chokim avalei l'meimar motzi chavero olav araya, kedin kom amon amutal b'safek rabbanon desumchus. And so he believes it is that case, but he says back in Gemara and Samach Bet Amud Bet that this is a case where the Chachamim felt that this was the best outcome. Now, what is the explanation of Rabbi Yossi then? Rabbi Yossi says she's entitled to her ketubah, but the kesef kiddushin that he gave, now we have a safek about whether it goes back or not. So we're going to split the kesef kiddushin. So if you remember, we said that a kikar is 25 maneh, a maneh is 100 zuz, and a shekel or a sela is dalet zuz, is 4 zuz. So now, the way that he explains it over here is, it's being an amanah who is entitled from her ketubah to 100 zuz. If he got married to her with 20 shekel or 20 sela, that means that he paid 80 zuz for the kesef kiddushin. Of that 80 zuz, 40 of it is coming back to him because it's mamon amutal b'safek. She keeps 40, he keeps 40. Now, he married an almanah. The almanah's tubah is worth 100 zuz. So now, if I take the 40 that she owes him, and the 40 that she gets to keep, the amount now that he has to make up for is 60 zuz. Because she's keeping 40 of the kiddushin, 40 of it she needed to refund to him, we'll count that towards the payment of the ktubah. So now you have 40 zuz already paid towards the ktubah. He's got to make up the difference. The difference is the shloshim chatzei seller, shloshim chatzei shekel, which is 30 times 4 is 120, half of that is 60. The 60 zuz makes up the difference that is owed over here. In the other case, kitshab shloshim, if the original kedushim was done with 30 sela, which is equivalent of 120 zuz, in that case, it's mamona mutal b'safek from the seyah de kedushin. She keeps 60, and she has to refund 60. So now he owes her 100 for the ktubat amana, and she owes him 60. So the difference is that he's got to pay up an additional 40 zuz. And that's what it says, notein la esrin chatzayin. He gives her 20 half sela. 20 times 4 zuz is 80 zuz. Half of that is 40 zuz. And that makes up the difference over here. That we already mentioned, the Balei Tosafot suggests the reason that it says Esrim Chatzayin and Shloshim Chatzayin is because that's the way that they valued things in those days. That was the mechanism or manner by which they expressed value. Others suggest that it's just a literary nuance, which is that Rabbi Yossi wanted to present it in a way where you could say the opposite. If it's 30, it's 20. If it's 20, it's 30. And you can do that by making the second valuation a chetzi rather than a whole. And that way, it's easier to remember, again, when you're memorizing these things, to say, if he gave 30, he has to pay up an additional 20. If he gave 20, he has to pay up an additional 30. So that way, you can get the two to be parallel to each other. And that's why he uses this chetzein over here.
So if you believe that kesef kiddushin nitivu'in ninhu, then there's nothing to speak about because the kesef kiddushin went to the woman and it's never coming back. On the other hand, if you believe that kesef kiddushin lav nitivu'in ninhu is not something that is gone forever, then you'd be subject to the original thoughts that we had here in terms of the machloket, depending on who's at fault and what the minhag of the makom is.
Again, if he passes away, then she can say, give me my husband and I will complete the marriage. My husband can't show up. I'm under no obligation to refund the money. So the situation where she would have to refund the kesef kiddushin is a case where she passed away and the failure to complete the marriage is because of her passing away. But if the husband wanted to get divorced or if he died, in both of those situations, he'd be the one who was the me'akev and therefore she would keep the kesef kiddushin. In the case where she's the me'akevet by being meita, that's where it's subject to this minhag. As to whether you return the kesef kiddushin. And now we have a statement from Rav Nachman says, Samar Rav Yossi bar Menuhin Amar Rav Nachman, B'chol makom shenagu l'achzir machzirim. In every location or in every place where the minhag is to return it, you return it. The Targuma, Narada, the explanation for this statement references to Narada. Narada is the city where Rav Nachman was. That was the shteller that he had. And so therefore, the statement that was made here, Amar Rav Yossi bar Menuhin Amar Rav Nachman, b'chol makom shenagu l'achzir machzirin. So what does it mean, b'chol makom? Every place means the place that is the minhag. Rav Nachman is the one who's speaking, so it's his city. So that's what the Gemara says here. That is the practice in Narda. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is, hein stam ayarot, normal cities that have no practice in place, im smuchala Narda, if they are suburbs of Narada or close to Narada, irsh machzirim ba tidon kol Narada kemoa, then Narada or anything that's around it will have the same din. Now the Gemara asks, shar bavel chutz midarmai. If they're not in the perimeters or the suburbs of Narada, then what should be the minhag? What should be the default situation in those cases? So Gemara says, Rabba Rav Yosef Damrei Torvayu mohare hadre kiddushe lo hadre. The mohar is returned, the kiddushin is not returned. As far as the kiddushin are concerned, that's what we've been discussing until now. Is the minhag to return the kesef kiddushin or not to return the kesef kiddushin? Or the last version of it in the Gemara is kiddushin l'tibuin ninhu or lo l'tibuin ninhu? Is kiddushin given to be lost or not given to be lost? And that would be the determining factor in whether you refund it. So here Rav Nachman says, kiddushin lo l'tibuin ninhu. That's where it's subject to this minhag, as to whether you return the kesef kiddushin. The practice in Narda is that it goes back. And here we have the remainder of Bavel says Kiddushin doesn't go back because you believe it's the Tevuin Ninhu. But on the other hand, the Moharei, the gifts are given back. Over here, the Brishbam says Moharei, the Hain Sivlonot, that these are the gifts that we spoke about before that are given at the time of the Erusin. Whereas you can see here in the Ravenu Gershom, it's in the second wide line on the left side, Moharei, Hadre, Haino Sivlonot. Those are the gifts. Tachshitin Shnoten La'lachar Kiddushin, the jewelry that he gives to her after the original Kiddushin. Na'gulak Zir Imeta Ogirsha. In that case where she passed away or he divorced her, the minhag is to give that back. Kiddushe lo hadre. On the other hand, Kesef Kiddushin doesn't go back. The Brishbam says, I don't agree with that. Virinira Beinai Detrei Gavne Ninu Moharei V'Sivlonot. I think Moharei and Sivlonot are completely different issues or items. Tahagabe Sivlonot Nami Achi Paskin Alanda Kaman. Because the Gemara gives a separate Psak Alocha in the Mishnah upcoming about Sivlonot. And therefore, they are two different items that are given at two different times. Veishlamar demoar hu amagmon shemagdim la ata bimei rusin shei kotei bektubata kishetina selo hachi mikrei mohar. So he says that mohar is not sivlonot, not like the jewelry and the gifts and the clothing that's given to her at the time of erusin, but rather it's the money that is cash that is given to her at the time of the erusin. But it's a cash that is intended to be written into the ketubah. It's the equivalent of a forward deposit on what the husband's going to bring in and give in the ketubah. The ketubah has written in it both the properties of the dowry brought by the woman, nixei tzona barzel, nixei malog, what she is entitled to get back at the end, aside from the core monies of the ketubah. The husband then is written into the ketubah as to what he brought or gave in to the marriage. So over here, he's giving in cash, not cash gifts that are just going to be exactly that, cash gifts, but cash gifts that are going to be enumerated in the ketubah. And he says it's called mohar because that's what the Torah calls mohar ha-betulot. Means the monies of the betulot. It's money that is associated with the marriage. And therefore they call it mohar, not sivlonot, which are gifts of the marriage. That was Rabbi of Rabbi Yosef. Amar Rabbi Papa, Yochata. Ben Shemaitu, Ben Shemaitahi, Bahadur Behu, the case where he passed away, or she passed away, or he backed out of it. Moharei Hadre, the Mohar goes back, whether you think that's Sivlonot, or whether you think that's the money that's a forward payment on what's going to be included in the Ketubah. Kedushe Lo Hadre, the Kedushin are not returned, similar to what we just saw in Rabbah and Rav Yosef. Hadra Ba Ihi, on the other hand, if she backs out, afilu kedushei nami hadre, then even the kesef kedushin goes back. So, in the situation where he passes away, she passes away, or he backs out of the marriage, meaning that he divorces her, in that case, the moharei or the sivlonot, depending what you think, definitely go back, but the kesef kedushin remains. On the other hand, if she is the one who backs out of the marriage, then even the case of Kiddushin are returned because she's the one completely at fault here for the non-completion of the marriage.
So to summarize the opinions, Rav Nachman seemingly believes that Kiddushin lav l'tvuah ninhu, that Kiddushin money that's given away is not a permanent gift, something that you don't expect back, and therefore it's subject to minhag. And the minhag in Narda, the place of Rav Nachman, was to be machzir, to return the kesef kiddushin. We don't have any clarification as to in which situations that's true, but we would assume that it's governed by the principles that we laid out above. On the other hand, Rav and Rav Yosef believe that the practice in the remainder of Bavel is that kesef kiddushin l'tvuah ninhu, that once you give away the kesef kiddushin, they're gone forever. And there is no getting those back. So no matter what the circumstance is, the Kesef Kiddushin are not even in play. The only question is with regards to the Mohar or the Sivlonot as to whether those are returned or not returned. And then we have the qualification of a Papa who, like Rabban Rav Yosef, believes Kesef Kiddushin Litvuyin Ninhu, and that we would not expect them back, with one exception. And that's the exception of when the woman dissolves the marriage. Because in that case, the husband never intended for the Kesef Kiddushin to stay with her, if she dissolved the marriage. So it's almost like a carve-out, which says that in those instances where she dissolves the marriage, then he does hold on or keeps a string attached to the kesef kiddushin. In the remainder of the cases, we assume that he surrendered them completely and doesn't expect to get them back.
Meimar amar, kiddushe lo hadre. Kedushin don't go back. Zera, Shem Yomru, Kedushin Tovsim Bachuta. The fear that we have here is that people are going to think that Kesef Kedushin can work with her sister. I mean, that what really happened over here is that there was a marriage and a divorce. If you refund the Kesef Kedushin, what it looks like to an outsider is not that there was a marriage and a divorce, but rather there was a failed marriage. That the Kiddushin or the Kesef Kiddushin was given bitaot, and now it's being refunded as if there was never any Kiddushin. It was Kiddushei Taot. Not that there was a marriage and a divorce. And the result of that is that people are going to then think that they were not married, and therefore you could use Kesef Kiddushin and marry the sister. Because two sisters are not allowed to, b'chayehem, as long as they're alive, to marry the same individual. That means if one is married to a woman, he may not marry the sister in the lifetime of the first wife. If the first wife passes away, then he can't marry the sister. Over here, if he now wants to go and marry the sister, well, if they were married and then divorced, he may not marry the sister because his wife or ex-wife is still alive. On the other hand, if the Kiddushin failed Mi'ikara, it was Kiddushei Ta'ot, it was never married to this woman, then marrying her sister would not be a problem. So what Reb Meimar says is we don't want to refund the Kesef Kiddushin because of the fear that people would then think that he could have Kiddushin with the sister. It's a little bit of a problem because there's only one person to worry about here, and that's the husband. Nobody else is precluded from marrying either of these women, and there's nothing wrong with these two women. The only question is, can this individual who was involved in this issue, can he marry the sister? That individual knows that there was a divorce here and not a dissolution of the Kiddushin retroactively. So why do you have any chashash at all? Rav Ashi Amar Gita Mochiach Alea. She has a get. What's the question over here? She gives back the Kesef Kiddushin, there still was a divorce, and she's holding a get document. The get document is a public matter. And therefore, people will know that she was divorced because it was a get given. Any document that has a deem that's signed on the document, we assume has a kol. And then people will know about the fact that she was divorced. What do you need the Kesef Kiddushin to prove that she was married and then divorced? The get itself should be that evidence. Ba'ad Rav Ashi bedutei. That which Rav Ashi is saying is a little bit of a joke. It's not serious. Dika neshama b'ha, b'lo shama b'ha. Because some people might have heard about the return of the Kesef Kiddushin, but not have known about the get. In that you're asking people to be aware of too many facts here in order to assess the case properly. And since that's the situation, we're not going to believe that people are always going to know what exactly transpired. And they're going to think that there was no divorce, but rather an upending of the Kiddushin from the beginning. And then you would think he's permitted to marry his sister, but even though in truth he's not allowed to marry her because there was a divorce, and it's marrying a sister in the lifetime of her sister, and that's not permitted. That's why we say that don't return the Kesef Kiddushin in that case, in order not to give that mistaken impression. And again, the only person that's at risk here is really the husband, who does know the information. So either you have to claim that maybe he's an Am Haaretz, he doesn't really understand that even though he gave a get, when he gets the Kesef Kiddushin back, it doesn't mean that they unwound the Kiddushin. Or you have to say that the term here is much looser. We're not saying that Kiddushin, just people won't know who their relatives are. I mean, that if there are relatives in terms of a brother coming in and marrying this woman, which he's not allowed to do, that's an Eshet Ach. So he can't marry the woman. There are other parties that do have preclusions here, depending on whether there was a marriage or there wasn't a marriage. And so that's what's being clarified over here, is that we wanted to keep the case of Kiddushin to make it absolutely clear that she was married and divorced, and not simply that we unwound the Kiddushin retroactively. Right, so Shushbinut Nigveit Bebeitin, the mission says that a Shushbinut is an outstanding obligation, a quid pro quo, but it's a court enforceable obligation that you have. Tarabanan, Chamisha Dvarim Nemru B'Shushbinut. There are five things that are said about this obligation of repaying, being the quote-unquote best man at the wedding, the person who is going to provide the gifts and celebrate along with the Chatan. When Reuven does it for Shimon, Shimon has to do it for Reuven. So now, the Gemara says there are five principles here. So number one is Nikveit Bebeitin. It's a court-enforceable obligation, and if you don't pay it back, if you don't give the monies, you can go to court and demand the money back or the return of the gift. Bechozeret Ba'onata, it's only paid back in its time. That means that the obligation is not an outstanding obligation by which the person can come to you at any time and say, pay me back the money that I gave towards your wedding and that I celebrated with you. He only has one right of collection, Ba'onata. At its proper time, which is when he gets married. When you get married, then you get the return of that gift or the return of that outstanding debt. So you can't go to court and demand it beforehand. You can't go to court and say, give me my money, I'm not getting married. But you have to get married. That's the way that it works. It's a quid pro quo. And it comes back at that time. We saw before that onata is at the end of the sheva brachot, in that you celebrate along with the chatan. At the end of the sheva brachot, you give him the gifts or the monetary gifts. Vein ba mishum ribit, and there is no effective interest in the repayment of this. For instance, if they give unequally. So the first one, when he got married, gave him 100 zuz. And then when he came back to repay him at his wedding, he gave him 200 zuz. So that could be, in a sense, looked at or viewed as interest. You basically lent him money. You went to his wedding first, you gave him 100, knowing that you're going to get that 100 back at your wedding. So basically you're lending money until the point of time that you get married. So now when he comes back and gives you double the amount, it's as if you lent him 100 and he's paying you back 200. So it should be effectively that you're paying interest over here. We don't say that, and we don't classify it as being interest. V'ein shvi'it mishamatata, and shvi'it doesn't wipe it out. Shvi'it or shmitat ksafim that takes place in the seventh year that wipes out any outstanding loan will not wipe out this obligation as far as the shushpinit. V'ein abachor notel pishnayim. And a bechor, and we saw this actually in the previous Gemara, will not take a double portion in that obligation to pay out the kesef of the shushbinut. That's again when it goes to the estate. That was that one case, or the unusual case, where the individual had gotten married. At the end of Sheva Brachot, he passes away. So the shushbin was there celebrating with him all along, but he has yet to pay him because the only payment comes due at the end of Sheva Brachot. But the husband passed away at that moment. Then the woman has yibum with one of the brothers. So the Gemara over there discussed who does the payment go to then. The payment of the shushbinut, which now is obligated to pay because he was there for the celebration, he got married, he completed all the hoops that he has to jump through in order to get the money back, but then he passed away. So the money wasn't paid yet. When the brother steps in to be the yavam, is he entitled to get that kesef shushbinut? Or does the kesef shushbinut go to the estate as a whole? The Mishnah told us, and the way the Gemara interpreted it, is that it goes la'emtza. It goes into the estate as a whole. The yavam is not entitled to the kesef shushbinin, even though the yavam is entitled to all the inheritance of that brother. He basically steps into the shoes of that brother, and he gets a double portion, like a bechor. He gets his own portion, plus the brother portion of his brother, whose shoes he stepped into. Despite that fact, he's not entitled to the shushbinut over here, because the shushbinut is known as what's called ra'oi v'lo b'muchzak. It is something that is on the come, not something that is already in possession or in hand. Because of that, the yavam is not entitled to it, because the pasuk says by the yavam, v'ya ben ha-bechor. Again, as I mentioned yesterday, even though the pashtuta pasuk is speaking about the baby born from the yibum, that the oldest child will be named for the one who had passed away from the deceased, nevertheless, Chazal, Darshim, Ayah ben HaBechor, referring to the Yavam, that the oldest brother should be the one who performs the Yibum, as well as the fact that he gets like a Bechor. That portion where he picks up the Yerusha of this brother, he picks it up the same way that a Bechor picks it up, which means that only in things that are Muchzak is he entitled to, but things that are Ra'oi he's not entitled to. So just like we said that by the Yavam, the same is true here by the Bechor, which is that the Bechor is not going to get a double portion in the Shushbinut that would come into the estate, because it's ra'oi and not mukzak. Now, all of these are for a similar reason, which the Gemara is going to discuss now, why these five halachot apply. So the first one is nikveh bebeitin. It is an obligation that can be court-enforced, maitaima, kemil vedamya. It's like a loan. It's like you're lending him money with the expectation that he will repay you that money when you get married. Ve'im ba mishum ribit, but it doesn't have interest on it, delav adayta da'ochi yoidle, because that's not his intent when he gives him the money. You just said two things that seemingly are the opposite. You say it is a loan, therefore it's a court enforceable right. On the other hand, you're saying that it's not considered to be a loan for interest. And that's because the Gemara says that there is no intent for this. When a person gifts the money in the first place, he knows he'll get it back. When the other party goes to gift him money, even if he gives him in excess of what he received, when he gives it, he's not giving it to pay him back for the loan. And in excess of the loan, he's just a more generous guy, or he feels better about him. It is not something precipitated by the loan, or by the fact that this other party was his shushbin, so therefore now he lent him money, he's going to give back 200. It has to do with the feelings engendered between the parties. And so he says, you know, I'm wealthier. He got married later, and I now worked for a while. I had a job, so now I can pay more money, and I'm going to give him a bigger gift. I'm generous. It's not related to the original payment that he received. The only thing related to the original payment is that core amount he has to return. He has to minimally return that amount. Anything in excess of that is just a gift or a measure of good feeling. It's nothing to do with the loan itself. As the Rashbam explains over here, Elamitok simchat re'ut hirba b'doron. Has to do with the love and the friendship. He just gave a bigger gift. It's not related to the loan or the outstanding amount that he has to pay back. It's simply about the good feelings and good cheer between the parties. That is true not only of the person who's returning it now, but the original gifter didn't give it as a loan. He gave it because of the friendship and love between them. It turns out that it is an enforceable loan, but that's not the intent or the reasoning behind the granting of the gift. And the Shvi'it does not wipe it out, does not forgive the loan. The lo karinim bei lo yigos. Because there isn't a problem of lo yigos. Lo yigos is you may not press the individual for repayment. So any loan that involves pressure for repayment gets forgiven at Shemitah Ksavim in the Shemitah year. Any loan that does not have embedded in it an ability to pressure for payment, then that loan is not subject to Shemitah Ksavim, because the Shemitah Ksavim is when you're coming to collect, we say that, stop, you don't have a right of collection because you can't pressure him to collect anymore. On the other hand, if there is no pressure to collect, that's because either it's as if collected, or there's a fixed time for repayment. In that case, the Shemitah is not Mishamet. So the examples that are given in general are, first of all, Pruzbol, which is that you hand over the loans to Beit Din, then you no longer are pressuring for repayment of the loan. The Beit Din is going to enforce it, not you. And therefore, there's no longer any lo yigos. And given that, there is no Shemitah Ksafim. Another thing that's not subject to Shemitah Ksafim is a fixed maturity loan. If you have a loan that is extended for 10 years, and you can't collect early, you can only collect after the 10 years are up, then there's no lo yigos. Because you can't pressure him during the interim period, so the Shemitah doesn't have to save him from the pressure of repaying the loan. The loan's not due. The loan's not pressured until it's due. So that's the equivalent here of the Shushbinut over here, is that the Shushbinut involves a loan that extends over a larger period of time. It's not a loan that it comes due at any point in time, except if there is a marriage. So when there is a marriage, he has to do the quid pro quo and pay it back. But that means it's a loan that can't be pressured to be paid back early, or that you can pressure the individual to pay at any time. There's only one trigger for that loan to be paid, is that when he gets married. And therefore, it's not subject to Shmitat Ksafim. The Baya Tosafot over here with regards to Shemitah say the following: Mikan haya mevi Rabbeinu tam raya de kaimalan kalishna batra de perakama de makot. The we paskin like the latter lashon in the Gemara Makot. Damar Yudah Meshmol malvet chaveiro leesu shanim. If you lend out money for a fixed duration for 10 years, en shvi misham matato. Shvi does not wipe out the loan. Vavagav daati liday lo yigos. Even though eventually there will be pressure for repayment, which is at the day, time of the maturity, at the 10-year point, there will be a pressure to pay it back. Hashta mielo krinim be lo yigos. In the present, in the situation where we find ourselves, there is no pressure for repayment. And given that there's no pressure for repayment, there is no shmitat safim, there is no forgiveness of that loan. Vayakein magia Rabbi Yaakov mashisara payit Rabbi Yaakov was a kain. And therefore, Rabbeinu Tam fixes the piyut of Rabbi Eliyahu HaZakein, Zman Eser Kesef Ki Ilavenu B'chatzi Yamav Yazvenu. That when your person loans out for 10 years, in half of his time, he will lose it. Because he believes that Shemitah is going to wipe out the loan, even though it's a 10-year loan. So Rabbeinu Tam took that out, or fixed it, so it didn't say that, because he thought that that was the wrong psak. Vein Rabbeinu Tam Posekein Elikalishna Batra. He doesn't hold like that piyut, but rather like the Lishna Batra. Didlei Ein Shviyat Mishamatato Umagia. And therefore, when he rewrote the piyut, he wrote it this way: Zman Eser Kesef Kilavenu Velobe Mishpat Chatzi Yamav Yazvenu. He will not lose it at the half point of his life because it's not subject to Shmitat Safim. As an aside, it shows you the power of piyut in the time of Rishonim. The piyutim, and many of the things that we have actually in our sidurim, we don't say many of them anymore, but those yotzrot and the piyutim
First were written by tremendous Talmidei Chachamim, and embedded in those items were halachot, halachot maaseh. And you see over here, the Rabbeinu Tam is upset by a line in a piyut. So he doesn't just say, forget it, it's just a piyut. He goes and fixes the piyut so that it gives you the right halachic outcome. So it just tells you the standing of piyut in the eyes of the Rishonim, because instead of dismissing it, he actually is magia. He changes it, he edits the piyut in order that it fits with his halachic reality. Veini radari raya mikan. It really says, I disagree with the Rabbeinu Tam, and I don't think there's a proof from our Gemara over here. Lo shaycha klal shushbinut the milveh. Shushbinut and milveh are two different things. Sherei mikama dvarim eim mechalukim ze mizeh. There are a number of items that are different between them, including, maybe, that shmita is mishamet. V'shema l'olam lo yavo lidei l'igos. The difference between shushbinut and a loan is that a loan, by definition, will always come under pressure for collection at a certain point. It may be, you're right, that he has a window in which there is no pressure because you haven't reached the maturity date. But at the maturity date, there's going to be pressure to repay it, and therefore it is subject to egos, and therefore the Shemitah should wipe it out in order to be low egos, that you don't have a right to pressure him. On the other hand, Shushbinut, yes, it's possible it could come to a possibility of collection, but it doesn't have to come to a collection. Could be that it will never be repaid. It will never reach the point where there is pressure to pay it, because he never gets married or he passes away. Whatever the reasons are, there is an outcome by which there will not be any ghosts. And for that reason, he says, that's why Shemitah is not mishametik, and therefore you cannot extrapolate from here to the case of a milveh. And by a milveh, Shemitah would be mishamet, even if it is a 10-year loan. So the Baal Tosafot of the Ri says that it's a contingent liability that's court enforceable, but it's not a loan that's going to be subject to egos. And therefore, the Ri disagrees with the Rabbeinu Tam's conclusion, and the Rabbeinu Tam, and also over here, the Rashbam, his brother, both suggest that this is similar to a loan that is extended over a fixed maturity, whereas the Ri thinks that they're two different cases, and therefore, just because over here by Shemitah doesn't impact it, doesn't mean by a loan that it won't be impacted by the Shemitah. Obviously, this has significant ramifications to halacha as to which loans are subject to shmitat safim, whether a fixed maturity loan that extends over a period of time in which there'll be no lo yigos during the period of the shmitah, so whether that's subject to shmitat safim or not subject to shmitat safim. Ve'en ha-bechor notel pishnayim, davele ra'oi. And the bechor doesn't take a double portion in it because it's classified as ra'oi, as something on the come. Not an asset that's already of the estate. As we already passed earlier in the Masechta, that a Bechor is only entitled to a double portion in the existing assets of the estate or the absolute assets of the estate. When it's something that is on the come, then you do not have a right to take a double portion in it. The reason being is that there's no guarantee that this payment or this asset will ever reach the estate. Because if the individual never gets married, the assets will never reach the estate. That's what the Baal HaTosafot will say over here, that even according to those that say milveh lo havi ra'oi, that an outstanding loan that's going to be repaid to the estate is not considered to be ra'oi, it's considered to be an asset of the estate, and the Bechor gets a double portion, shushbinut mi havi ra'oi. Shushbinut, nevertheless, is ra'oi, ki shema lo yipara lo li'olam. It's a possibility that it'll never get paid back. That's what we noted over here. So for that reason, it's called ra'oi and not mukzak. It's not like Yerusha, or something that's going to be passed to you, that for certainty it will reach you or it will come to you. Over here, it's a potential asset of the estate, which is if the brother who's entitled to this gets married, then the estate gets that money back. But if he never gets married, if your chas v'shalom passes away, the estate will never be the beneficiary of that asset. So given that, it's called ra'oi and not mukzak. All right, Amar Rav Kana. Kalalala de shushbinuta. This is the principles that should govern shushbinut. Hava b'mato, if you're in the city, then ibayle l'meita, you got to show up at the wedding. So if you were given shushbinut at your wedding, and now your friend is getting married, and you're in the city, and he's getting married, you need to show up at the wedding. You show up at the wedding because part of shushbinut is to celebrate with him, plus you give him the gifts at the end. You're here, you're expected to be at the wedding. Shoma kal tavla, if he heard the bang of the kind of drum or a tambourine, the Bach over here quotes an alternate view in the Rishbam, which is that this called tavla was tolim bekeresh echad, take a big board or a big stick, zug anbo, and they put a bell on top of it, and then they go around swinging the bell, ringing the bell in order to indicate that there is a wedding.
So they used to go around the town and bang on the tambourine to indicate that there's a marriage, there's a wedding going on. Today they use the darbuka. They go around and you know that there's a bar mitzvah coming down to the kotel because they're playing on the darbukas. Similarly over here, so they go around town and announce that there's a wedding. He should show up. So even though he didn't get a personal invitation, the fact that it's being announced to the city, he's aware of the wedding. If he's aware of the wedding, he should show up at the wedding. Lo shama kol tavlo. If he's out of town, or he never heard the announcement, so he wasn't invited personally, he didn't hear the public announcement about the wedding, then the obligation's on the chatan to inform the shushbin that he needs to show up, because he's not going to know. So the obligation to invite him, or to make sure he's at the wedding, devolves upon the chatan when the shushbin is not going to get the information by himself. But if the shushbin knows about the wedding, because he knows about the engagement, knows about the wedding, or he knows about it from the public announcements, then it's an obligation on him to show up, even though he didn't get a personal invitation, even though the chatan didn't reach out to him, because it's a liability that he assumed when he received that shushbinut from the individuals getting married now. Now, what happens if he doesn't let him know? He should have let him know about it, but he didn't let him know. So now the shushbin did not get to show up at the wedding. What's his obligation in terms of payment if he didn't show up at the wedding? You could see this happening for a number of reasons. It could happen because of the circumstances mentioned here in the Gemara, which is that it was an accident or there was a misinformation or a lack of communication, and therefore he doesn't show up at the wedding. Or it could happen because there was a falling out between the parties, they no longer are friends, they live too far away. Whatever the reason is, there are multiple reasons as to why the shushbin may not show up at the marriage. Then, taromit idlei shlumei mishalei. The shushbin, who's supposed to show up at the wedding, can complain. He has something to say to his friend for not inviting him, but he's still got to pay the money. He owes the money, he's got to pay the money. Just because you didn't get invited to the wedding, or you didn't show up at the wedding, doesn't exempt you from the obligation to pay. But you do get a deduction. Vad kama. How much is the deduction you get to take? That is because when you show up at the wedding, you are going to eat at the wedding. You get a serving at the wedding. You're going to have to get the caterer to give him an extra plate. He's going to be there for Sheva Brachot. He's going to be eating all week long. This guy says, you know, the amount of money that I would have expended on you to be here, you saved all that money. So now that you saved that money, maybe I should give you a smaller gift. And that's exactly what the Gemara is suggesting over here. His missing the wedding means that the chatan had to pay less money to supply him with the food or whatever it is. So now, when he gives the gift, he should deduct from that the missed food or the missed opportunity that he had to celebrate at the wedding. Now, what are those principles? Amar Abai Nagu B'nei Ganana Adzuza. So the B'nei Ganana used to say, until Azuz, then you don't have to pay anything. I mean that if you were obligated to pay Azuz as your shushbinut, we assume that you would eat Azuz worth of value of food at the wedding or at the Sheva Brachot. And therefore, it's an offsetting liabilities, and there's nothing owed anymore. Aita bikape, achle bikarse. What he was going to bring in hand, he ate with his belly. Or in essence, he would cover his own costs. If he's going to give the shushbinut of azuz, he would have eaten azuz of value. So they're offsetting values. So had he showed up at the wedding, he would have given the gift, but eaten that much. So now that he didn't show up at the wedding, he doesn't have to pay anything because neither party lost over here. Ad arba'a. If the shushbinut was 4 zuz, mishalein palga, then you pay half. The reason that the Rashbam says over here is because came into mevi dalit, since he gave a bigger shushbinut, regilim la hachilo berevach. They tend to give him a larger portion at the meal. You get the fancy meal, you get the luxury meal, he gets to go to the shmorg, he gets all those bonuses. So since he's giving a bigger shushbinut, he was going to get better treatment at the wedding, and he would have expended more money in order to entertain him at the wedding. So therefore, he can deduct 2 zuz, half of the 4 zuz, even though in a normal situation, we would assume he needed a zuz worth of value. Over here, where the gift is bigger, we would assume that he would have 2 zuz of value that he would have gotten out of the wedding. Mikan ve'elech, if it's a greater number, inish kichashivute. Each person according to their standing. So the way that the Rashbam learns it is that the bigger the gift, the more expensive or the fancier the catering that is done for this individual. So there is some sort of equation between the size of the gift and the amount that you would eat or the type of food that you would get at the wedding. So as you go up in terms of shushbinut and size of that gift, you also, the deduction will go up to match on a commensurate basis the foods and the preparations he would eat. So that's the way that the Rashbam reads it. All right, Tanu Banan. So now here we have this understanding that the whole Shushbinut is built on this idea of a quid pro quo, which is that you celebrated at my wedding and you gave me gifts. I will return that favor to you at your wedding. I will celebrate with you and give you gifts. How far does that quid pro quo go? That's what the Gemara is about to discuss. We're going to see here that the standards are very high in terms of what is considered to be the quid pro quo. Tanu Banan, asai mo bepumbi, if he had a big public wedding, ubikesha soti mo betzina, and the chatan now that's getting married wants to have a small, quiet, private wedding. I want to return the favor. I want to celebrate in public with you the way that you celebrated in public with me. So that the nature of the weddings are different now. The way the Rashbam expresses it, it makes a difference in the simcha, in the celebration that's associated with it. A large public wedding is going to have a higher level of celebration when you got married. And I want to pay you back with a chuppah and a situation in which I can celebrate with you and there'll be a large celebration. I don't want to come at a time when everybody's quiet, it's a small group here, it's not so much excitement, it's going to be less to eat, it's going to be a smaller scale wedding. That's not the quid pro quo that I envisioned. And therefore you can say to him, I will not be a shushbiner, I will not pay the shushbinut, because the wedding that you are making is not equivalent or similar to the wedding that I made. And therefore, I don't have to give back the shushbinut. The Rebbeinu Gershom also notes, when it's a public wedding, he doesn't want to come to a tzanua wedding. He makes the following comment. Tibitzniut lovi simcha klum. That when you do a quiet, low-key wedding, there's not really any simcha. So he speaks in terms of the nature of the joy that's associated with the wedding. It has to do with the nature of the wedding. The small, intimate wedding is not as joyful or as happy as a normal wedding. He even says, v'lo klum. It's not a simcha at all when you have one of these small weddings. Asaimo bibitula. If a person who got married was marrying a bitula, ubikesh lasotimo ba'almana, the second party who now is getting repaid for the original shushbinot is not marrying a bitula, but rather marrying a widow. Yacholomarlo bibitula asaimcha kader shasita imi. When you marry a bitula, I'll do the shushbinot. I'm not going to do a shushbinot for almana. It's for the same reason over here. The marriage to a bitula is a much happier, more labedic type of wedding. And he says, I want to celebrate on an equivalent basis with you. I don't want to be in a case where it's an almanah, which is a toned-down wedding. So what the Breit is saying is that the obligation has not come due. The only time that you have to pay your shushbinut is when the obligation comes due. His right to say that you have to have a wedding that was similar to the wedding that I had makes that the obligation only comes due where the quid pro quo is on equivalent basis, weddings of a similar nature. And so if it's not a wedding of a similar nature, he's not obligated to be a shushbin in that case. Asai imo bishniya, ubikesh lasot imo berishona. So if, the way that the Rashbam reads it, if the original shushbin was done for a second wife, so then the one who's getting paid back is getting married to a first wife. Yecholomarlo, you can say to him, l'shetisa isha acheret eseimcha. When you get married the second time, when you take a second wife, I'll celebrate with you because you came to celebrate me with a second wife. I'll do the same for you when you take your second wife. Asayimo be'achat. If he did it with him with one, ubikesh lasotimo b'shtayim, and he wants to do it with him on the Yecholom Omar, be'achat asay imcha keder shasita imi. I'll do it with the one the similar way that you did it to me. So the Balei Tosafot explain over here, asayimo be'achat ubikesh lasotimo b'shtayim perish, that I'm willing to celebrate at one wedding for you, but I'm not going to celebrate at two weddings because you came to one of my weddings. I'm not going to have to break it down into two weddings and have to come twice. That's the way that the Balei Tosafot say it. Then he says, that the Gers is actually the other way around. If he had the Shushbinut with two women, and now he wants to do it with one wife. When you get the second wife, perish. You are shushbin at my two weddings. So now he wants to get paid back. And he says to him, I'm going to do for you the way that you did for me. I had two weddings and you gave to each of those two weddings. You can't now demand that I consolidate the shushbinot and give it back to you when you're first wife. When you have your second wedding, I'll give you back the other half of what I owe you. You can't have it that, no, I'm only marrying one wife, so you give me all back my shushbinot with that one wife. No, you have to replicate what I did. I had two weddings. You have to have two weddings. I'll pay you back the first one at the first wedding, and I'll get to the second one at the second wedding. The Gersa of the Sfarim is like what I said, although the Baal Tosafot said the way that I explained it can be the same thing. That if he says to him, look, I went to one of your weddings, but I'm going to have two weddings, so why don't you give me half in each of these weddings? He'll say to him, no, that I'm willing to celebrate at one wedding for you, but I'm not going to celebrate at two weddings because you came to one of my weddings. I'm not going to have to break it down into two weddings and have to come twice. That's the way that the Baal Tosafot say it. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here says, Kshinasa isha achat, when she married one woman, Bikesh shiparlo kshinose shtayim kachat. It's a case, not where he got married to them sequentially, but he got married to two women at the same time. Obviously, there has to be a seven-day break between them, but he's getting married to two women. Lo avya kol kach simcha b'shtei tzarot. When you get married to co-wives, that is not as a big a simcha. Alechol yamar lo shetisa libincha ulachecha betula achat o isha rishona efralecha. So then, obviously, he can't pay him back now, because once he marries two women, there's not going to be a case where he marries one woman. It's never going to be the same situation as what he paid. So he says to him, you know what? I'll pay you back when either your son gets married or your brother gets married to Betula, in the same way that I got married, which is to one woman at a time and only one wife at that time. You are taking two wives in one shot. That's not as big a simcha. First of all, they're co-wives. Second of all, you're having two weddings. And therefore, I don't feel like I'm obligated to come and pay you back in that way. So that's an interesting explanation of the Rabbeinu Gershom. The Gemara here brings down a braita that might be connected because of the word pumbi between them. It is a braita that brings down terms that are really a mashal or metaphor for something else. And that's the discussion in the Mishonim as to what the metaphor is. Tarabanan, atir nichsin, atir pumbi, ze pala gadot. Someone who is rich in possessions, he is a public, wealthy individual. So the way that the Rashbam explains it is that he owns possessions that everybody knows about. That he owns vineyards, he owns olive orchards, he owns animals, things that people are well aware of, and therefore his wealth is well known because everybody sees the assets. His assets are very visible. So that person who is wealthy with visible assets, then he is a public wealthy individual. Gemara says that's a metaphor for a Baal Haggadah. It's a metaphor for the one who is, the Rashbam says, the Resh Barabim, Bebate Mishtaot. The one who is the Resh Barabim in the festivals or in the wedding halls. This is your classic pulpit rabbi or a person who is a great darshan who can interest the people and he can get them excited about that which he speaks about, whether it's on Shabbat, on Yom Tov, or at celebrations. And everybody comes to hear him because he's very charismatic and dynamic. And he has a way to speak in a wise manner or a captivating manner. Since Haggadah or Haggadah does not require such in-depth learning, he has the ability to go to many places. So there seems to be an association between the Baal Haggadah and this wealth that is all public. The reason that he's such a well-known public speaker is because the content of his speeches are not so deep. They're more superficial, easier to understand. People enjoy them. And so he gets a certain amount of fame from the fact that he goes around giving all these drashot. But that is precipitated by the fact that what he's speaking about is not so deep. And so for that reason, he's compared to someone who has many assets that are visible, which is that he gives drashot that everybody knows about, but all that's there is that which is visible. There's nothing deeper than what you see. So you can see this in one of two perspectives, even though it's a positive statement about the Baal Haggadot of his successes in spreading Torah to the masses and the fame that is associated with it, or you can look at it in a negative light, which is the lack of depth in that which he speaks about, and his ability to connect the crowds makes him popular and famous, but doesn't mean that he has any real content to him. Just like his wealth is all a public view, underlying it, we don't know what his real assets are or what his real financial situation is. So now the next case is Atir Slaim, Atir Tekoa. The one who is wealthy with Slaim means monetary wealth. And that's not he's a money changer or he's someone that is in business and therefore his wealth is not visible because you don't see the assets of his wealth. He's able to put his money in the bank. He's able to hold on to the coinage by which he is making his money. And therefore, it's not as obvious that he is wealthy. That person is Atir Tekoa. So the way that the Rashbam explains it, Yesh Mifashim, Sheesh Lo Batim Harbei. The only way that you know that he is wealthy is because he owns a large house. He owns many houses. So the display of his wealth is not through the assets themselves, but rather the money that he spends on his lifestyle, I would call it. His lifestyle shows you or demonstrates you that he must have wealth. That's how it's known to the public. And the Rashbam claims that it comes from the Yaakov Taka Ohalo. That when Yaakov set up his tent or pitched his tent, that's what the word Tekoa means over here. Means that he pitched houses in a sense, but that's how you know about his wealth. Veli Nira, after quoting that, the Rashbam says he thinks that the proper explanation is Tekoa, which is the name of the city, Alpha Lishemen. Is Alpha, like Aleph, is the best for oil. And we know that from the Mishnah Menachot, they used to bring the oil for the menorah from Tekoa, because they had the best olives and the best oil from there. That's what it means, Alpha the Tekoa Shemen. And so when he says the Tekoa, so that is like oil. Money and oil. Zeu Baal Pilpul. That's a person who's involved in Pilpul. V'dima lemat beyot v'lishemen et ha-pilpul. Hashem shemarviach yom yom tamid bipilpulo tamim harbei kishar mat beyot v'tamei hashemen shemivim v'tekoa. Since he's involved in pilpul, every day he comes up with new ideas, new concepts. So it's exciting, like someone who has money can exchange it for other money, can make money with that money. Or someone who has shemen and who has oil or the best oil enjoys the taste of that oil all the time. Or, according to those that say that it's batim, he has many houses, the Rabbeinu Gershom says, umosif mi pilpulo al shmuato. He's able to add on to that which he owns. So that's the houses. Just like an individual who is wealthy can buy more houses, and in buying more houses, he always gets rental income. So his rental income is always coming in. So too, someone who's involved in pilpul always has something new or something going on. Atir mashach. Atir Kamas. So now, one who is wealthy, the terminology Mashach usually would refer to Shemen. But of course, with the Rashbam, you can't say that because he already said Shemen was in the previous case. And therefore, he says Atir Mashach means Anshei Midot. Something that's measured, and that it means he's wealthy with that which is measured. Like Tvua, like produce or working of the field, which are measured items. They get you what you get. Whatever you have, that's the value that you have. It doesn't expand beyond that. You may be very wealthy, you may be very successful at it, but it has limited profitability expectations beyond that which you have. So whatever is measured, that's what you're going to profit. Atir Kamas, he quotes from the Pasuk in Azinu, Kamos Imadi, meaning Chatum Ba'otzrutai, things that are kept in my silos, things that are kept in storage. That's how the Rashbam reads it. Zeu Baal Shmuot. That is the person who has a large wealth of Torah Shebaal Peh or Shmuot. It's an individual who has tremendous bikiyut in Shas, the bikiyut in Torah. So he knows all these halachot and memrot of the Amarim, and whenever the time comes, they ask him a question, he'll tell you what he knows. So it's the same thing as a silo. When the time comes, he opens up the silo and he sells the produce that he has inside. He's not continuously doing anything. He's not making extreme wealth or making things out of nothing. He simply has what he has, and there's a time when he opens it up, and that's when it's useful. So the Rashbam views the Baal Shmuot as being positive, which is that people always need the information from him and always come to speak to him about issues. On the other hand, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom learns it is that it's a negative statement. He has all this knowledge that he has anything to do with. He has to wait for someone to come and query him, for someone to come and invite him to get engaged. Otherwise, he doesn't have anything to do because all he has is a big pile of stuff, but he doesn't know what to do with that stuff. Because he explains over here, Shoshomea mi pi rabo, yodea ma shoshomea, ve'enu mechudad kodach, yishayadeh lachadeh shtavar midato. So he has the knowledge base, but he doesn't know what to do with that knowledge or how to make that knowledge into something more. Everybody needs the Marei Chitaya, where the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it as, she'en adam yechol lechiyot below chita. A person can't live without wheat or can't live without bread, so too you can't live without this individual. That is an expression that is brought at the end of the Gemara in Brachot with regards to the Gemara's question, which is better, Mara Chitaya or Oker Harim? Is the one who has the large quantity or the one who can undermine or turn over the mountains? Basically, the question is Bikiyot or Iyun? Is it the one who has vast knowledge more important? Or is it the one who can answer questions, figure things out, extrapolate, do pil-pul? Was he the better one? The Gemara over there answers that the Marei Chitaya is the better one. Shakol tzrichim lo. Everybody needs him. In the end, you're going to be mefalpel if you actually know the underlying material. So everybody needs that, an equivalent of going to a book in order to get the information. That might have changed today, where things are in the printed form, whereby you don't need someone who knows everything about Pe in order to get the information. You can look up the information yourself. So maybe today, the person who has the Iyun is maybe greater than the one who has the Bikiyut, because the nature of the Bikiyut has changed. It's not Baal Pe anymore, and therefore there's not this tremendous need to be able to check with people to find out the Shmuot, because you can actually read them in the Gemara itself. So in that context, so that could be that it's the end of the previous statement, which is that a kol tzrichin l'marei chitaya is a reference to the one who has everything there. Although then it makes the reading of the Gemara very difficult, because then the Gemara, or the word Gemara, is left isolated. On the other hand, you could read it now as a lead-in to the next statement, which is a kol tzrichin l'marei chitaya Gemara. That refers to the person who learns Gemara, and the definition of Gemara, according to the Rashbam, is sugiyot Gemara, like our Gemara. The Teirutze Mishnayot or Braitot, he's able to answer up the stirot between the Mishnayot and Braitot, try to make understanding of it, try to bring together a unity of Shas through his pilpul and understanding of that which is there. And so then the Gemara, or the Baal Gemara, is the one who can give the Psak Halacha, the Halacha Lemaseh, because he's the one who can resolve the issues, which the Rabbeinu Gershom quotes, Shein Adam Yechol Harot Isur Veheter Lo Ledin, Ki im Baal Gemara sheyodeh lefaresh lachkor hakol. So Rashbam points out over here that the Mehavle Olam, those that destroy the world, are those people who pass and have the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah is a short form that needs to be resolved in order to get to a Psak Halacha. So someone who just has the knowledge base, but doesn't have the depth of understanding, the ability to reconcile, question, then he's not going to get to the right halachic Psak. And so therefore the Baal Gemara is the one who is either a kol tzrichin l'marei chitaya. He's the one that's needed over here. So there are those that want to explain a kol tzrichim l'marei chitaya Gemara doesn't refer to the pilpul, the ability to understand and reconcile between the Mishnayot, but rather it refers to shmuot and misorot that one can't reach through pilpul. So pilpul would be the logical way to get to things, whereas Talmud would be the misora, which a person needs in order to reconcile or deal with certain issues, because they can't be solved logically, or they can't be solved just through one's own mind. And that would be the difference between Talmud and Pilpul in that case. Otherwise, they sound very similar. And you'd have to differentiate between Talmud, which would be an understanding or reconciliation, lehalacha, whereas Pilpul is a way to create and be creative in your learning and understanding. Doesn't necessarily mean for lehalacha lemaaseh, but a way to expand the knowledge base that you have, extrapolate it, and bring its meaning to other places. What is meant? That all the days of the ani are bitter or difficult. Zebal Gemara. That refers to someone who learns Gemara. Tov leiv mishteh tamid. The one whose heart is always happy. Zebal Mishnah. That's the one who's learning Mishnah. So over here, the Gemara does not take the pasuk literally, which is that the days of the poor are difficult and misery. Whereas Tov Lev Mishteh Tamid, the one who is enjoying the feast and enjoying the festivities, he's always in a good spirit and in a good mood. As the Marashah explains over here with regards to the Pasuk, that you have to say something beyond the Pashtu, the Pasuk, because of the inconsistency between the two statements in the Pasuk. When the Mani we're speaking about could be speaking about his reality, his physical life, but the comparison to the Tov Lev Mishteh Tamid, it's speaking about a feeling or an intangible item. It's saying tov leiv. Someone is of good spirit, of good heart, feels great, Mishteh Tamid is involved in festivities and celebrating all the time. So if we were to equate the two sides, then we're speaking about the Ani. It can't be an Ani in the sense of his physical poverty. It must be an Ani Ruach. It must be somebody who is in spirit or in his feelings is somehow impoverished. That's what the Gemara says over here. That the Ani refers to the Baal Gemara, as the Rashbam notes over here, Shememit Atzmo the Kavein Halachot the Terei Tzavayot. He expends tremendous energy and effort in order to answer up questions, in order to reconcile, in order to get a psak halacha. And that's why he's an ani. He's in misery because he's always trying to solve the problems, always trying to figure it out. And that leaves him in a position where it's not as enjoyable. Whereas the one who learns Mishnah, he's in the lap of luxury. He feels great all the time because he doesn't see any problem. He just sees everything as being knowledge, but he doesn't see any issues between the Mishnayot. Rava Amar Ipcha. Rava says just the opposite. Behainu damar Rav Misharshia Mishmei de Rava, my dechtiv. What is meant by Messiah Avanim Yatsev Bahem, Bokeya Itzim Yisachein Bam? The one who quarries stones will be hurt by them, will be saddened by them. If you learn the word Yisachein from the word Sikun, he will be endangered by it or be harmed by it. We'll see that the Rishonim of here have a different view of what the Yisachein means, coming from the word Sochein, which means to nurse or to comfort, rather than the word Sakana, which would mean to endanger. Messiah Avanim Yatsev Bahem, the one who quarries or chisels stones will be saddened by them. Elu Balei Mishnah, that refers to the people of the Mishnah. Bokeya Itzim Yisachein Bam, the one who splits wood will be Yisachein Bam. Elu Balei Gemara. Now as the Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Gishom explain over here, the Yisachein is Lashon Chamimut, is heating up and warming up. Kamo Vatila Melech Sochenet, like by David HaMelech and Abishag HaShunamit, that she warmed him up, she kept him comfortable. Klomar Shenehenet Mehem, that you get the benefit or you get the enjoyment out of them. So that would support Rava's view that the Balei Gemara are in a happier place than the Balei HaMishnah. Because the Lashon of Ye'atzev means Bitzavon, you will eat through the difficulties, despondency, Adam HaRishon, after the Chet of the Gan Eden, that Hashem says, produce that you get is only going to come through Etzev, through sadness. So that's why it says that Messiah Banim Ye'atzev Bahem, that refers to the Balei Mishnah. That refers to the Balei Gemara, which is a much more positive reflection on the Balei Gemara than the Mishnah. And then that's supportive of Rava flipping it and saying, Kol Yimei Ani Ra'im. The days of the Ani are miserable. That refers to the Balei Mishnah. Because they have the knowledge, but they can't figure out what to do with it. They find stirot, they find problems, they don't know how to reconcile it. The Balei Gemara are enjoying things because they're able to figure out the solution to the problems. Rabbi Chanina Omer, Kol Yimei Ani Ra'im, Ze Sheyesh Lo Isha Ra'ah. What does it mean that all the days of the Ani are miserable? That's someone who has a difficult wife. Dov Leif Mishteh Tamid. The person who is always enjoying life and things are happy for him is Ze Sheyesh Lo Isha Tova. That's the one person who has a wonderful wife. Rabbi Yana Omer, Kol Yimei Ani Ra'im, Ze Istinis. V'tov Leif Mishteh Tamid, Ze Shedato Yafa. All the days of the Ani are miserable. That refers to someone who is very particular. Say he's so particular, every time he bumps into something that disgusts him and gives him upset, he spends his whole life in misery because he's bumping into things that always bother him. On the other hand, a person who is Dato Yafa is a person who is easygoing. Things don't bother him. He can let things slide. He's not disgusted by things. He's not upended by things. He enjoys life much more because things don't bother him along the way. Yochanan Amar Kol Yimei Ani Ra'im Zerachman. That it refers to someone who is very merciful, which would seem to be strange that you would say that a person who is merciful, his life is miserable. So if you look in the Rashbam, he says, Kama inyanim uro'eh, v'kama mu'ro'ot shalibo bocheh tadir aleyem. Rabbeinu Gershom suggests, Shadoeg b'tzar kol adam. He worries about everybody else's standing and how they're feeling. He sees incidents, he sees things going on, he knows about people, everything makes him upset. And since everything gets him upset, he spends his whole life in misery. It is because he's commiserating with others, but it still leaves him in that state of being where he's always miserable because he is a Rahman. On the other hand, someone who is Tov Leib Mishteh Tamid, Zeach Zari. That is someone who is indifferent. His indifference gives him the ability to not care. and not caring, even though in and of itself it's not a good midah, but it does allow the person then to always feel happy. He doesn't see anything bad in the world, doesn't see anything going wrong, because he's never commiserating, he's never burdened by the things that are happening around him. All right, then, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Amar, Kol Yemei Ani Reim Zed Shedatzo Kitzara. That is someone who has, the way that the Rashbam explains it, is Kitzara, Kamo Atzran V'Kabdan. Someone who is a miserly and holds things back. He doesn't like it giving to himself, doesn't like giving to others. He's very stingy. That person spends his whole life in misery because he's always trying to hold on to what he has. He doesn't allow it to be spent. He doesn't enjoy himself. That's one who spends more generously. Someone who enjoys the money that he's collected and gives to others as well. That's someone who enjoys life more. That's the way the Rashbam explains it. The other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom suggests is, Shadato Kitzara is a ragzan. Someone who gets angry. The person who gets angry lives his whole life in misery because he's always getting angry over things. So obviously, if you think Shadato Kitzara is someone who gets angry, then Shadato Rechava, again, would be somebody who is easygoing, someone who lets things go by and slide, that they'll enjoy life more. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Ko Yimei Ani Raim, Vayika Shabbatot V'yamim Tovim. What about Shabbat and Yom Tov, where, even though during the week things are difficult, and even though there is less food on Shabbat and Yom Tov, first of all, we have the distributions to the Aniim, so they get food for Shabbat, they get food for Yom Tov, they can enjoy the Mishteh and the days of Shabbat and Yom Tov and the days off. Kiddush Shmuel, even those days are miserable for them. Damar Shmuel, Shinui Veset, Tchilat Choli. Person who changes their normal behaviors, their normal patterns, that's the beginning or the indication of sickness. So Shmuel says it in the Gemara Nida with regards to a cycling of a Nida. And there he says, Shinoi Veset, the changing of the cycle of the Nida, Tchilat Choli, is an indication of sickness or the onset of sickness or causes sickness. So here the Gemara applies it even outside the world of Nida, which is anything that is the normal behavior of the individual. A person has a pattern of behavior. A person has a normal way in which they conduct themselves. When they change or deviate from that, it ends up causing tchilat choli. It ends up causing sickness. So if a person all week is eating in a small amount, he doesn't have meat because he can't afford it. All of a sudden on Shabbat, he splurges and he has meat and he eats all this extra food, he's going to be miserable afterwards because that change in the nature of his body is going to make it that he's not going to be able to handle it. It's going to make it difficult for him. There's a story told about Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. He grew up in extreme poverty. And he ate barely anything his whole lifetime. Stories are told that he, at some times, that the whole meal was a hard-boiled egg. And that was for him and his sister. And they had almost nothing. At his wedding, afterwards at the Sheva Brochot, they were serving meat at the Sheva Brochot. And he had some meat, and he became ill from the meat. So I wondered what was going on. It turned out that he never really had eaten such rich food before. He never had really an experience of having something that was so luxurious. And it made him feel ill because of that. So it's a similar idea over here, that when you change from your normal course of behavior, a normal menu, then these things have impact on you. So even here, where there's a respite for the aniim in Shabbat and Yom Tov, it turns out to be difficulty as well. Because that change in their normal behaviors or their normal eating makes that they end up feeling ill or feeling uneasy, and that makes their whole lives miserable. Tevis Sefer Ben Sira. It's written in Sefer Ben Sira, which is a work in the time of the Tanaim in the Bayit Sheni, was found in the Cairo Geniza and reconstructed. Kol Yemei Ani Raim, that's the pasuk that from Mishlei. Ben Sira Omer, he adds on to that. Af Leilot, not just are his days miserable, but even his nights are miserable. Why? Yishefel Gagim Gago, his roof is the lowest of the roofs. Mimatar Gagim the Gago. And therefore all the water pouring off the other roofs lands on his roof. So he's down, basically downhill from everybody else. And so when it rains, all the water and the gutters pour the water away from the houses that are uphill. And it lands in his yard or in his roof because he's the one low down, or that's his roof is the lowest, or the fact that he is lower down the mountain. This is actually borne out by anybody who's visited Gamla. When you go to Gamla, Gamla's built on a very steep, sharp-topped hill. And when they excavated it, they saw that the largest houses were at the top of the hill. The wealthy people or the richest people lived at the top of the mountain, and the poorer people lived down towards the wall of the city, away from that center. So that would be exactly the description here. The people who are wealthy at the top, their sewage goes downhill. The water pours off their house goes downhill. It all lands on the ani. So the value of living uphill was for the ashirim is that all their waste and everything that came away from them poured onto those that were around them. Number two is they have better protection because the aniim are a buffer between them and the outside world or the walls of the city. During the other way around is Barom Harim and Carmo. On the other hand, his vineyard is at the top of the mountain. He gets the worst of both worlds. In his residence, he's at the bottom of the hill, so everything pours down onto him. In terms of his farming or his orchard or his vineyard, that's at the top of the mountain. So anytime it rains or anytime things come and wash away, it washes away his fertilizer downhill to the people who are the beneficiaries lower down the hill. Also, in order to go to work and run his plows, he's got to go all the way up to the top of the hill to do all of that. And so therefore, his property or his possessions are at the top of the mountain. And therefore, the dirt, the soil, the fertilizer from his orchard flows downhill to all the other parties. So everyone else is the beneficiary of the work that he does in his orchard. It pours downhill to the other parties. That's what Ben Sira says, that not only are the days of the ani miserable, but so are the nights. Because even when he goes home at night, his house, you could call it, is tight, it's closed, it's not easy for where he lives. But even worse is that all the water from the city is going to pour onto his house because he's at the bottom of the barrel, in essence. And so therefore, he adds on this aspect that it's not just his days, but his nights. Being poor or being impoverished affects you everywhere and all the time. And therefore, the statement of Kol Yemei Ani Ra'im is expanded to say not only the Yamim, but also the Leilot. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Kuf Mem Vav Amud Aleph.